Okay, so thank you for staying for so long. So we'll start right again the round table. Don't forget that we would like you to ask questions, to feed the discussion. So I thought perhaps to start the ball rolling, I would ask Bernard Bergonzi a question about the choice of the power and the glory as a set book for the examination, having in mind that possibly and probably for many of our students, it was the first Graham Greene book they read. And perhaps connected to this question, the fact that one of the originalities of Graham Greene is probably that most Greenians have a different book, that they say this is my favorite book, this is really the book by Graham Greene. And I know, and Bernard Bergonzi repeated it this morning, that his favorite is not The Power and the Glory but Brighton Rock. So would you
say why?
Well, possibly why. Yes, why Brighton Rock? And also, do you think that The Power and the Glory is a good choice to initiate prospective readers of Graham Greene?
I think it is a good choice for first readers because it is a very simple story. And this is not to sound derogatory, but it's it does give you this single sense of a process, a chase, a pursuit, and even in some aspects a pilgrimage. It's trying to give the good one to start, but as I said this morning, it's untypical because up to that point he'd written about England in a very kind of documentary precise way, but with a poetic dimension, that he was actually taking popular fiction, the thriller and so forth, and turning it into a mode of real literature. Why I like Brighton Rock is he does that. I say in my book that Brighton Rock is thicker. It has a thicker dimension. Well, you may say, well, so what? I mean, that is just one possible criteria. I would put The Power and the Glory as the second place, in the second place, I think, because it is a work of extraordinary power and intensity. But I say in my book, the intensity is rather like a jet of water under pressure. So it's a strong jet. Whereas Brighton Rock and some of the earlier ones, you move in different areas. They spread out more. You're in sort of partly in the territory of the thriller, partly in that of precise social observation of English life. As I said, In The Power and the Glory, he abandoned so much. His capacity to observe and to pick up popular speech and all the rest of it, and still produce this very remarkable book. So, yes, I think it is actually, if people are unfamiliar with Greene, a good one to begin with, but I hope they then go on and explore others.
Right. Okay, may I ask the same question to Catherine? I mean, do you think it's a good choice, personally, The Power and the Glory?
To introduce I've never read.
Yeah, well, I know you had read Graham Greene's novels before, but thinking of some of our students who may not have read any, or will it stop them from reading any other books of Graham Greene? I hope not.
Well, we don't know. If we think that it is not really representative of his work, as you argued this morning, that it is a kind of parenthesis or untypical novel, then perhaps it is not the best novel to introduce them to the world of Graham Greene. But it's just certainly a much more complex novel than appears at a first reading.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When I first read it, to be honest, when I first read it, I thought, oh, Lord, what am I going to show the students? This is going to be like a catechism, etc. And then reading it again, you begin to go beyond that first reaction. And so I hope the students will also go beyond that first reaction.
I'm sure. Michel Norman, what would you say?
It's obviously a good choice insofar as it is the book, which is like a reference. Yeah. One says this other novel by Graham Greene is different from The Power and the Glory. There is some position in the whole works of Graham Greene, which makes it quite important. It's, I would say my favorite would be the Honorary Consul. And I think also for students a good start might be a burnt out case. But of course one has to make a choice. I think it was the obvious choice.
Perhaps a question on language. This morning Bernard Bergonzi mentioned the fact that really in the book the characters are supposed to speak in Spanish and being in Mexico, even though we knew that the priest had some knowledge of American English, or English, is American English English, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yes,
okay, no, but then you ended up by saying that, in fact, the language used by Greene did give this feeling that obviously the characters were not speaking English.
Yes, and I think he did this by just adopting a very simple, unidiomatic English. I mean, the language is quite subtle, in fact, as our friend showed in his elaborate discussion this morning. But what he doesn't have is sort of slang and popular language and all those phrases that you get in Brighton Rock and in all the earlier ones. He had to restrain himself to saying, this is what it would sound like in English, although it's actually supposed to be in Spanish, apart from the bits, the occasional bits in English when the priest...
A few Spanish words, but very, very few.
Well, I think that's rather tiresome. It's like a Hollywood touch. Somebody says, buenos dias, or adios, or some salud, or something like that. That's what you get in Hollywood films. Where you just somebody starts speaking in a foreign tongue, and they rapidly move into English to reassure you. But I mean, I think on the point of language, a friend here mentioned the Honorary Consul and Burnt Out Case. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a curious thing of some interest to French people, and I don't quite know what its significance is. The three of Greene's later novels are set in more or less French-speaking communities. That is to say, in Indochina,
Quiet American.
I'm total nominal aphasia now. I cannot remember any proper names. Yes, the Quiet American, it was still under French rule. So when Fowler talks to his girlfriend, his Vietnamese girlfriend, they speak in French. Mm. French being the language of the, at that time, still the colonial power. Burnt Out Case is set in what was still the Belgian Congo, just, which I suppose was partly Flemish-speaking, but the central figure, Query, another Englishman who speaks French to the Belgian priests there. And, of course, Brown in The Comedians, Haiti, another French-speaking country, is another Englishman who speaks French to the people in Haiti. Now, that's a curious fact, but it has no significance of any larger kind, as far as I can see, except that we know Greene spoke French well and lived in this country for many years. Incidentally, I was fascinated to see that extract from the Truffaut film this morning, which I'd never seen and only heard about. But Greene actually comes on, he speaks in English. Mm-hmm. Whereas what I gather from was when Truffaut wanted some Englishman to come in and do this little part, he wanted an Englishman who spoke French. That was his original requirement, and Greene was supplied, unknown to Truffaut who he was. Mm-hmm. Somebody said, here is this tall Englishman who speaks quite good French. But in fact, he spoke English. And then there was a translation, so that requirement was clearly not followed through. But anyway, that might be a matter for somebody to write a paper on Greene's French-speaking English central figures.
You do that. Yes, there's even Greene on a tape. In fact, the tape from the Graham Greene birthplace there. And there is a part in which Greene speaks partly French. Yes. Very nice. There are songs as well, but not by Greene. Mm. That Greene asked to
listen to. What about you, Christian, on language, your chase of metaphors and metonymies?
No, we talked about during the break about the codes of Spanish and English, and it is quite surprising. And in the way some of the words are used, sometimes it says silencio, in the cemetery, and then in the garbage heap it says no litter, where it should be, of course, in Spanish.
Yes.
Sometimes it is Spanish when it should be English.
Yes.
So the codes, these codes don't really function well.
A scattering of local colour, I think, is all one can say.
It's really a scattering, which is a bit clumsy.
Yeah.
It's difficult, I agree.
It's perhaps sometimes impossible for a writer who is at ease with several languages to know when he's going to use one. Mm-hmm. We have the case in France of André Brink from South Africa, so who can write a novel using African languages, English and French. And he says that he writes the rough copy of his novel in four or five languages, and he doesn't know why he shifts from one to the other. But it comes like that.
Mm-hmm. What I meant is that there is no coherence.
But in a final version, one should find a code, but obviously no.
Similarly, the same situation, sometimes English, sometimes Spanish, without any reason. So there is no system.
Maybe somehow you trace the fact that he was very much of an outsider, despite his being relatively involved in the community. And I saw, I noticed exactly the same thing, and I thought that it betrayed his want of showing some kind of exoticism, which may be limited, despite his great experience traveling in Mexico. So I thought it betrayed it.
Yes, being an outsider, of course, this doesn't apply to the power and the glory, but later on, Green chose to live in France. He lived in France for about, on and off, about 35 years, really, particularly in Antibes. And it wasn't only, as Anthony Burgess put it, not very kindly, for tax evasion reasons, because anyway, Tony Burgess did exactly the same in Monaco.
Yes.
So it's not that, but he was. You're quite right. He wasn't as yet, but he wasn't an outsider and traveling all around the world. Now, about the question of local color and exoticism, because the same issue, in fact, occurs with the. With Conrad, he's one of his models. I mean, many critics say there is no local color in Lord Jim or in Heart of Darkness. It is much more than that, which is true. But on the other hand, you do find short passages where there is a little bit of exoticism or local color. Would you say that this applies to The Power and the Glory as well? Apart from language, the way the situations are created, that obviously there is something typically Mexican, as the readers of the 30s would see and understand Mexico, which may have changed now.
Well, the phrase that comes to my mind is something that Green wrote. I think it was in The Lawless Rose. He said, Mexico is a state of mind, which
That's
is
right,
very
yes.
important because... Yes. Somebody who knew Mexico in the 1930s might say, this wasn't like this at all, you know. It's very easy to say, oh, this author's got this all wrong. There was this and he doesn't say about that. But a novelist is actually working in a state of mind. Green invented Mexico. And he says something very similar about the Congo in A Burnt Out Case. Mm-hmm. Almost exactly the same. Congo is a state of mind or state of feeling or something like that. So you can't actually sort of... match it up against the reality. That's why I think The Lawless Rose is important, because this was a work of observation, and perhaps there he has to sort of get closer to what might be called verisimilitude. I don't know if he does or not, but it still makes a wonderful book.
Of course, all this is very Conradian now, all of these ideas like the Africa of the mind, or very, very similar. And no wonder that critics who wrote on Conrad, including Norman Sherry, in fact, also worked on Graham Greene. And you are in the same sort of company, in a way.
So much so that that distinguished English novelist, now dead, Anthony Powell, or Powell, a man of strong opinions, I think in one of his notebooks he says he didn't see very much in Graham Greene, just a second-rate Conrad, he said. Which is a totally dismissive way. But there is that connection. Yes, Greene is much more like Conrad for all sorts of reasons, and he's like many other of his contemporaries.
And what he wrote about Mexico also perhaps explained the fact that the American edition changed also the title of his books. Really.
I can't think why they called it the Labyrinthine, which is not a very attractive title. Well, it's not easy to know what it means, and you need to know Francis Thompson's poem.
Yes.
Whereas The Power and the Glory, straight out of the liturgy, is a strong and powerful title, but they changed it back after a bit. That was just somebody's silly idea in the publishing office, I think.
Yeah. Also, I think on the American edition, they said that this was either the story of... they tried to say that things were not as bad as they appeared in the books, which is true. In The Lawless Road, really, it's not really a guidebook that would... make you want to go to Mexico.
No, it wouldn't. No.
So they try, and they're the same for Brighton Rock, the film. Some of you who viewed the film at the beginning, there's a warning, but that's the British on the British side, and said that it was the Brighton of the time when there were poor slums.
The local authority in Brighton were very reluctant to have that made unless there was this disclaimer. This was Brighton as it used to be long ago.
And yet you can use it as a guidebook. All the streets are still there.
I think a lot of the slums have gone, where Pinky grew up. Those Brighton slums have gone. But Montpellier Road, where Pinky can live, that's there. There were two piers in Brighton, and one of them was severely damaged in a storm some years ago, and it was abandoned. Then there was talk of it being restored, and then mysteriously the remnant of it was burnt, and it is regarded this was an act of arson by people who wanted the West Pier to be the only, no, the Palace Pier to be the only one, and the West Pier, they didn't want that threatening them again, so... That was the story. Can't be proved, but so it could never be restored now. So, but that comes in both in Brighton Rock. There were both piers functioning.
Now perhaps a question for Armand Goulipian.
Yes, I wanted to say that.
Yeah, go on, say.
Yes, you spoke of the books by Greene, which you liked.
Yeah.
Of course, I like the Catholic novels, which I read 20, 30 years ago.
Yes.
But I've read more recently the new books by Greene, the latest books, and I advise you to read Monseigneur Quixote. It's both funny and tragic. And you can see different aspects. There are more priests than in The Power and the Glory. Monseigneur Quixote is faced with his superiors. He meets other priests. And you can see Greene's conception of religion. He doesn't accept all the hierarchy, all the discipline, all the doctrine, etc. And it's very funny. He treats... very deep questions in a humorous tone. I think you will like it. And there's also this idea that sometimes you can't make the difference between fact and fiction, which is very Borgesian as an idea. The fact that we don't know if we are not just a dream. Someone is dreaming us. It's an idea by Borges. And sometimes you can't make the difference between fact and fiction, and this is repeated in Monseigneur Quixote. He's traveling. You know that he met a Spaniard, and they became friends. It's a priest, and the priest became a specialist of Greene, and they met and they traveled together. And Monseigneur Quixote was inspired by this Spanish friend, and both of them traveled in the summer with the car. plenty of wine in the car, and they stopped in many places, and they met living people, which who are, you can find them, their trace in the book. It's a very interesting book, very funny and tragic at the same time. There are plenty of characters. The servant is very, very funny too. She, Monsignor Quicksort, he has a car. He's called it Rocinante, and the car becomes a character itself in the story. So I would advise you to read Monsignor Quicksort. And there's also another one, more simple, if you like, more. It's a shorter book, The Captain and the Enemy. And the characters are very interesting, too. They are mysterious. And the captain, he has many names. He's a very strange, mysterious person. And you never know what he will be called from one day to the other. He's absent most of the time. The girl he lives with, he loves her, but he never told her, frankly. It's a very, very interesting relation because in Green's books, the woman is never really a true woman. Perhaps you agree that we don't find a woman really developed in Green's books.
One exception, I think.
Yes, just one.
In the end of the affair, Sarah. Yes. Is, I think, she is a really strong female character, based very much on Green's mistress of that time, Catherine Wollstone. I mean, I think it is a limitation in Green that he could not, on the whole, manage very convincing female characters. They tend to be rather simple versions of either the waif, you know, the sort of frail little girl type, or the brash, good-time right, yeah. girl. But they're both types. Whereas Catherine Wollstone, Sarah, she comes across really that. I think that is a. I've even argued that it stops Green being a great novelist because I believe that to be a great novelist, a male novelist, needs to create really convincing female characters, which the great novelists do. Flaubert with Madame Bovary, Henry James with Isabel Archer. James Joyce with Molly Bloom, and I don't think Green can quite do that. But then after I wrote that, it occurred to me, well, nor does Conrad, and we do regard Conrad as a great novelist. So either Conrad has to be downgraded, or I have to rethink my argument.
It's the same as being said about Conrad.
Yes.
Yes, I have a question for Sophie, which I did not have time to ask before. About the function of books in The Power and the Glory. On the one hand, books fulfill very clearly a nostalgic function. They are a source of comfort when he retrieves that book there. But on the other hand, and this has been disquieting me for a while, and I would like to have everybody's opinion on that, he condemns books. On page 179, he says that he equates books with harm.
With harm, and even life, but of course, life without books. Finally enables him to go through this phase of dispossession. So the time when the books were lost equaled the beginning of the revolution, something which himself is harmful. But at the same time, life without books is not only negative, and that can be related to what this young lady was saying. The fact that writing itself in a way is not only harmful, but is implicitly compared to sort of sinful or corrupting action. If you go back to this idea of the blank page and the signs upon the page. So it's part of all these images and symbols that can be reversed.
If I might, on that point.
What do you think?
I'm remembering Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. When Dr. Faustus is being dragged down to hell, he says, "I'll burn my books," you know, as though at that late point that was going to save him.
It's a sort of knowledge.
The curse of knowledge, yes. I think so.
It's not knowledge. It's not knowledge. It's encyclopedic knowledge.
Yes. It's probably knowledge. Closer to the way he uses the word knowledge in relation to Cole,
did.
Add something as well on the idea of the detective story that you've been working on, in fact. I mean, did you have this in mind before working on The Power and the Glory? Did you find it easy to adapt?
Not necessarily. Well, in fact, what happened is, I don't know if you remember, but it all started about 4 years ago when at the SIAC we were asked what we thought should be on the syllabus. And I was interested in the blurring of the limits of the genre, so I suggested something that is true is probably too easy for aggregation. But that would, it would be a good introduction to Graham Greene, because I do not see why only 23-year-old students should start reading Greene. Maybe you can start earlier than that. And I suggested Our Man in Havana at the time, and everybody went, no, that's too easy. So that was when they suggested The Power and the Glory. So I had that in mind. A long time ago, started working on suspense story because that was what I was trying to get when I suggested Graham Greene originally for the Agreg. And so I did have that in mind, and I've been reading a little bit of Greene with that in mind. Since then, we've also organized an international detective fiction conference at the Catholic Institute, just not really far from here on Rue d'Assas. And we did have a conference as well on detective fiction, but it was, if my memory is correct, on Brighton Rock, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, so I do find that this constant reminder of the influence of what you read, John Buchan or French writers as well, probably Stevenson, yes. And so I did have that in mind. But just that in the end, when I did have to write this, it was, in fact, a terrible ordeal because the answer was, no, it's not a suspense story. But there are elements, and there are elements in a lot of his books anyway. So it's yes, but. So no, I did not find that easy. I started actually cursing myself for having chosen such a stupid subject. I spent my weekend cursing myself, and until this morning I was still cursing myself. But there are elements of detective novels. But it's true that if you really want something that is more classical, it would be Our Man in Havana, because officially it looks like a spy story. But, well, read it. You'll see why. You have the impression that you are being sold a spy novel, but the hero may not quite be James Bond.
Yes, but Delphine, following up on your idea of the novel of detection, I do agree that Brighton Rock would have been much better with this question, which is not, of course, a whodunit, because we know who did it from the very beginning, which at the time when he wrote was quite unusual. Now it's quite usual that you read a detective novel and on the first page you know, in fact, who is guilty, who know who the culprit is. But at the time, perhaps not so much. The question is, as Bernard Bergonzi knows very well, because he wrote a wonderful article about this, is how he was killed.
Yeah, how done it.
Actually, how?
Hale is murdered, simultaneously murdered by Pucci, and is proven to have died of natural causes from a post-mortem. He died of a heart attack, but Pinky killed him. Now, this is a kind of contradiction, which is never resolved in the novel. There are elements, then, of the sort of old-style nouveau roman in this that you never quite know, and I think Greene was deliberately sort of playing with the reader here.
The weapon is supposed to be a stick of rock, but they don't explain how...
I've argued against that. It's argued that he had a stick of rock thrust down his throat. It killed him. And this was put forward by Michael Sheldon, who is an American, who's not familiar with English seaside rock. I don't know whether you are, you people, but it's a solid mass of peppermint-flavoured sugar that is still very common, popular, but... It wouldn't. He said, it would dissolve and disappear. It would not.
No.
They're much too hard. So that's one point. The second point is, if you have that rammed down your throat, it will lacerate your throat. And he had a thorough post-mortem that showed all sorts of marks on his arms and so forth. They would have looked in his mouth and see. But in any case, it would not have disappeared and melted away to nothing. That was nonsense. But a great many people, including English people who should know better, have said, oh, yes, that's the answer. It isn't. But I did argue that maybe he started doing it, didn't actually get it right in, and then poor old Hale, who had a weak heart, he just died of shock. Now, that covers the facts. But in a way, I'd rather it didn't. I think that makes it seem a somewhat lame and laboured sort of demise.
On the other hand, if really the stick of rock is the object that really killed him, it's excellent, because first of all, you have the title, which can only be understood by British people, first of all, and then also the fact that you have the title and possibly the illustration, and I'm thinking of Agatha Christie, who hated the fact that the illustrations of one of her novels.
Well, the latest editions, you have plenty of elements.
Was guilty,
yeah. In the you have plenty. Well, if you are looking at the current, I think it's Pan editions, you have plenty of objects and you have clues. It doesn't say exactly who's done it. But it's pretty obvious if you just look at the details. You have a hat, a plume, whatever. you'd have, well, different elements that would give you the answer. So you have to avoid those editions. Try HarperCollins much better.
And then, of course, the most editions had to explain. In the American edition, for instance, they explain in English what a Brighton Rock is. And in the French edition also, and it would be interesting to see exactly how it was translated in other languages. I haven't done that yet, but it's quite easy. And also what sort of explanation they give. Rocher de Brighton is not a bad translation, except that a rocher, you can't really kill someone with a chocolate.
Totally different. Or is it le rocher? If it's le rocher, it's a complete...
Depends on the size, maybe.
It is interesting that certain popular artifacts and sweets and products simply do not change. That just when Green was writing in the 1930s, there was rock, seaside rock, familiar. And it still is today, exactly the same. Now, how many aspects of culture and technology can you say no change in 70 years? I think things like certain types of food and sweets, they are very resistant because people always want what they knew. They want it as it used to be in their childhood. So I think that preserves it. But on the title, of course, if you think that this was the first of Green's Catholic novels, you could then say, upon this rock I shall build my church.
Yeah.
But I think that would be going a bit too far. But I'm sure somebody would think, oh, that's a nice idea.
It's his first Catholic novel.
Yes, it is.
So perhaps, yes, we can have your questions now.
Well, I had a question for you, so that you could come back on your presentation and maybe expand a little bit on the idea of the tragic mode in The Power and the Glory. You mentioned that there was the emphasis was laid on the tragic mode halfway through the novel. Am I right? Yeah? And well, I'd like to have more detail about it. Thank you.
I'm not sure I have much more to say, but it's just that basically halfway through the novel, you know that he's not going to escape his fate. It's pretty obvious because you have the image of Judas, so we know that Christ died, so we have a small, slight idea that's going to happen again. So I have the impression, well, this tragic mode is... it's mainly for the priest, but you do have a few hints. That's what Catherine said as well. A few hints that maybe other characters are going to have problems. We do not know exactly what is going to happen, but we do have a few hints that Coral might never grow up and things like that. And so we do have other elements. So I concentrated on the priests, but it's true that you could also add, if I were to add, you know, spend more time studying this, I would probably try and study the fate of Coral as well. We have no details as to what happened to her. We know all of a sudden she's disappeared and everybody's gone. So we do have a few hints that she's dead. But you mentioned that you thought maybe it was a burglar or a thief or so. I didn't even get that hint. For me, it wasn't all that clear.
What I meant is that since the paper with the Green Ghost summons is written on the back of Coral's Hamlet essay, it means that he was in the banana station. Whether he used Coral as a human shield, as he probably did with the Indian baby, or whether she was killed in the scuffle, there's absolutely no indication. But we have that hint that something happened. And again, as in Brighton Rock, it's kept as a mystery, an ellipsis. Yeah. It's never explained.
I have the impression she'd become ill because of the references of a mother to...
her parents refuse to discuss it. It's taboo. The mother refuses
to
discuss it.
Yes, she refuses to discuss it.
But it's... yes, I think it's explicit that she died.
Yes, yes, obviously. So I don't know if this answers your question or not.
Yes. Each says it's the other's fault. The husband wasn't there. The mother seemed to run away, or leaving the daughter to cope alone. But it's in keeping with the whole family situation, as you described it. The girl who is responsible, and the parents constantly compared to children. The similes for the parents, they are compared to two children in different guises.
So, a question.
To make links between all that you've said today, and it's been a rich day. I was thinking again about the morality play, and I was linking this to what you said about books. This hate for books that the lieutenant feels. I was thinking, because he wants to persecute. He wants to persecute religious men. He hates religious books, obviously. I was thinking maybe he represents envy rather than pride. I was thinking about Dr. Faustus, what it is said about envy. He can't read and wishes all the books were burned.
Yeah. I mean, are you suggesting there was an element of the morality play in Dr. Faustus? Which there was, I think, and I think Green comments on this possibly in the book British Dramatists. He didn't think much of Marlowe, but he did like Dr. Faustus, and he does that some of those phrases, like "Well, this is hell, nor am I out of it," he repeats. And yes, I suspect there is an allusion to "I'll burn my books," or "books are." It is books that have undone Faustus. This pursuit of vain learning. How far it applies to the police lieutenant, I'm not sure. I mean, is he very much against books as such?
No. Not as such. No, he even says he wants to buy books.
He wants the book, yes. He wants them.
He wants. He
wants them
to
be. He wants them to be educated. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think this character, when it was created, and when the book was read in the 40s and 50s and even 60s, was a very interesting one, because he shouldn't be thought as a purely negative character. I think pride is the wrong term. Is someone looking for justice, and he thinks that justice involves eradicating superstitions. In one way, it's not wrong. He represents the hope of a whole generation of militants all over the world. And this hope was so much alive when the book was produced, and still alive in the 50s and 60s, that when I read it, I saw in this character almost the equivalent of the priest. Where is the truth? Is it one or the other? Maybe I was exaggerating the importance of this lieutenant, but he represented something. Well, he represented a lot of people I knew around me who were militants, communists, socialists, or whatever. So he should be seen, I think, with sympathy. One may be wrong. At that time, people were still quoting Lenin's sentence, saying what we had to do was terrible, but the generations after us will be able to understand and to forgive. Unfortunately, it didn't happen that way. They didn't understand and didn't forgive because they didn't got anything real from all the sacrifices involved in one given period. But in the 50s and 60s, it was not clear yet that this terrible investments in lives through executions and through authority was going to lead to complete failure.
Yes, it's a different reading according to the generations. It's often the case when a book remains read by one, two, three, four generations. People read the book for very different reasons. And of course here, as we have this idea of a sort of socialism or Marxism, things have changed so much, I mean, politically, not only in Mexico, obviously, so that the reading takes probably totally different shades of meaning that Green couldn't know. I mean, he knew quite a lot of things ahead of his time, but not everything. But you've mentioned that also, Bernard, about the fact that he also, I think Michel Lohmann as well, the fact that he foretold about the priests and Catholicism in South America and the way now they all this was already in the book.
Well, I'm not sure about that, you know. I think that we know what happened later. The liberation theology and militant priests, particularly the one in what's the one with Rivas in? Yes.
The
honorary consul. That was clear. You know, this was a man who'd abandoned some of the priesthood in order to fight for what he thought. And now, I don't think there's any of that culture or ideology in Power and the Glory. I think the Power and the Glory is very much about an individual striving, failing but still striving. And as I said, I think it is a fault with the priest that he's not sufficiently ideological, he's not sufficiently Marxist. Well, I could write some better Marxist lines for him to utter now than he does. What is interesting, I think, looking at it from a slightly different angle, is that you get in the book where the priest has been captured and he and the lieutenant are talking back and forth, and it's evenly balanced, you know, they each has a good case, which was something that Green did throughout his novels. It actually starts as early as Stamboul Train, but it goes through lots and lots of the later ones, and it's usually at night people sit up talking and arguing and debating Rivas and whoever the other party is in the honorary consul, they do it. So when this was an interesting side of Green as a novelist, that he liked a certain amount of debate and discussion without necessarily coming up absolutely on one side or the other, which may not altogether balance with the sense that we are totally dedicated to, we are totally on the side of the priest. I think he does make out a case for the police lieutenant and this notion of a kind of quasi-socialist liberation of the people, but it has very little kind of ideological content at that point, but nevertheless, it is interesting that there is that argument going on between them about their from their respective positions.
Yes, Colin.
I was just going to endorse the recommendation that you read Monsignor Quixote, and if you want a nice, gentle introduction to it, there's a splendid film available on DVD. So spend an hour and a half in a nice armchair with a glass of wine, watch the film, and then get
Spanish wine.
That's your favourite. Okay. More questions? Yes.
Sorry, a little question. I wondered to what extent can we talk of the sort of theatrical, dramatic dimension in the text, because you mentioned tragedy, and I wondered, I had just this thought, possibly all the surrounding characters have a sort of semi-choric function, but of course not to stress necessarily the tragedy, but well, the difficulty of taking precisely a synoptic decision as to what comes out of this situation, and all these elements concerning how you have some geographic elements coming in, and this idea of showing versus telling. I wonder to what extent can we use this idea of there being a bit of a drama there.
There was a play also done from the power and the glory.
Yes, yes. Yes, I don't know it, but I mean, Green did say that I quoted this morning. Yes, he's like a 17th-century play, and yes, it does have this simple grouping of people and that sort of action. My worry is it might be insufficiently dramatic because from a fairly early point, you know that he is going to die eventually. We don't quite know how, but. We don't seriously think he's actually going to escape, I don't think. But, yes, and it as Green said, it observes almost the unities of time and space and action. It all takes place within only a few days, I think, the action. And obviously it's limited. It is restrained by this claustrophobic Mexican setting.
But he moves a lot.
He moves, yes. He doesn't seem to get very far in another sense.
Yes, I know there was a play, at least in French. I'm not sure whether there was a play
in English.
I know it was actually acted there. There's still the document in the library. So, more questions on that?
I've got a question for Catherine. You mentioned the Fountain of Oil.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the historical context of all the oil companies being expelled. It should have that economic context, but what are we to make of the Fountain of Oil?
I think in the particular context in which it is set, it is simply an image of a potential richness spurting out and going to waste. The oil just gushing out and not being used or exploited, and it is the vehicle for a tenor, which is the religious sense in man. So, but it is in keeping with the sterility, the mineral environment, the general atmosphere of despair. I don't think there in particular there's any economic. Well, I'm not sure, but... when he's actually watching the mestizo sleeping, and it's the gurgling noises that he makes, the mestizo snoring, which, through association, conjure up the bubbling of the oil. It's through sound... I could find you the page... But yes, I think it's 95 or something. Yes, it's 94 and 95. First, it's the talkativeness of the mestizo. The man wouldn't stop. The priest was reminded of an oil gusher, etc. And then he is asleep, and there was an odd bubbling sound. The man was weeping. Again, he was reminded of oil land, etc. So it's on both pages, it's to do with the mestizo.
Yes, but I
It's very explicit. It was like the religious sense in man cracking suddenly upwards, a black pillar of fumes and impurity running to waste. So it's what should lead men to faith and goodness, etc., which spurts out and leaves the way open for sin and treats it treason. And it's an interesting conceit. It's
Now, about the character himself, Norman Sherry, in the first volume of his biography, said that he managed to meet the character who had inspired Green. And he was 30 years older. He had lost his tooth, actually, 14. But apparently he was much, much worse than in the book, where he's already just incredible. So, in fact, Green had improved the man himself.
I wonder if there is a tradition in Mexico of glorification of Judah. So an anti-priest for a Mexican might be somebody quite positive. Because, for instance, the parishes organize, some parishes in the south of Mexico and Guatemala, they organize every year, you pay for having the right to welcome in your house Judah. And it costs a lot of money, because when guests come to meet Judah, which is a dummy in your house, you have to provide drinks and food. But it's something very prestigious. It probably comes from the fact that when the Indians were forced to convert, they said that the Spaniards are so cruel that whoever is against the Christian God might be someone nice. And then they developed the idea that Judah didn't commit suicide because he regretted what he had done, but just because he realized that he could have had much more money than just 30 talents. So there is an inversion of values among Maya Indians, which is working absolutely parallel to their Christian faith, because nowadays it's quite easier for them. The churches are open to the shamans, and they work freely in the churches. The shamans, the traditional religion, is there working with the Catholic Church. And this, I would say, anti-conventional attitude might have seduced an Englishman, knowing who the English are.
Okay, thank you. So before thanking Bernard Bergonzi, I wanted to tell the aggregation students what Margaret Atwood and Graham Swift said when they came, and one of their books was on the syllabus for the aggregation, The Handmaid's Tale for Margaret Atwood and Waterland for Graham Swift. And I sent them, in fact, the sujet of the essay. And both authors told me we would never have got through the aggregation. So this should give you courage. So first of all, I would like to thank Professor Bergonzi, who has been so clear and who has given us ample food for thought, and all of you for staying with us for so long. Okay, thank you.